Our next presenter is Regem Corpus. He's a first-year dual master's student in public health and public policy. He was a LA Occupational Health Internship Program summer intern, researching on live-in domestic caregivers and the impact their work has on their sleep and overall well-being. Regem is primarily focused on occupational safety and health issues, as well as healthcare accessibility for immigrant workers. So please welcome Regem.
Good afternoon. My name is, as she said, my name is Regem Corpus, and I am a first-year master's in public policy and master's in public health. And actually, this is a very funny thing that I got in public health because I really came from a political science and labor workplace studies background in my undergrad in UCLA. But in my time here in the summer, it was really wonderful. I worked with the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance a year before, and I got connected here with OHIP, and we decided to work with the Filipino Workers Center regarding about domestic caregivers within Los Angeles and the impact of their work in their sleep. Do domestic caregivers have an opportunity to sleep? And that's what we were trying to find out this program. And of course, without a surprise, I don't have relationships to disclose. So what is the Filipino Workers Center? Well, it was founded in 1997, historic Filipino town in Los Angeles. Its goal, as most worker centers, was to provide immediate resources and services to its community, that being Filipino workers. Not only did they wanted to provide resources, but they wanted to be organizers around their safe working conditions, living wages, decent living conditions, and access to quality health care. So how did this project came about? Well, it was really helpful, especially within that time. There was a campaign for the California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, and there was the passage in 2014, AB 241, signed by Governor Brown. And what this bill does is that it gives a right to 1.5 times pay for overtime, right to minimum wage. They don't have rights to meal and rest breaks, and it does not require the employers to keep time records. So this could be very difficult with in terms of implementation. And it is sunsetted, so that means it expires in 2017. Now, it's very interesting that this is what makes our work urgent, because of the fact that a year before, there was another Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, and it was vetoed by Governor Brown. And in infinite wisdom, he says that he vetoed it because it would bring unnecessary costs to the patient and family, just because he would give you sleep rights, rest and meal breaks. But we know that is what our research was trying to disprove. So who are domestic caregivers? Well, they're both men and women. Majority are immigrants from the Philippines. Most of them are undocumented here in the United States. They come from varied work backgrounds. Some of them are health professions, being like certified nurse assistants. Some of them actually have become, you know, something from business, from entertainment, things of that sort, but it's a very interesting population. They are called domestic caregivers because they provide, well, live-in domestic caregivers. They provide in-home care for 24 hours per day. They provide care to the patients with chronic illnesses and physical disabilities, and they perform assistance with daily living. So that's something like grooming and bathing, and of course, instrumental assistance with daily living. So that means driving them to appointments, you know, feeding them, preparing their medications, and of course, they provide this care all throughout the night. This is not something where it's without base. Of course, we had looked into other research before in terms of other workers, in terms of sleep, and of course, their work performance and their overall health. We see this with both truck drivers and nurses, and we've understood that with the results that with their type of workforce, it really restricts their ability to sleep. We've understood that it really was detrimental not only for their health, but in terms of work performance. We see with truck drivers, fatigue causes 110,000 injuries and 5,000 deaths. Nurses, of course, sleep deprivation increases risk of medical errors, such as in terms of giving you medicine and of course, quality care. So what are research questions? Well, the first one is, what is the quality and quantity of sleep that domestic caregivers receive? The second is, what conditions affect domestic workers' ability to sleep? How does their sleep conditions impact the overall health? So we look into our participants. So they are live-in caregivers, but of course we had this criteria. We didn't want to just be very broad. We wanted to specifically look at the ones who really work for a long time. They work at least 4 days a week, so that means they're primary domestic caregivers. There's also relievers, but we're looking at primary live-in caregivers from Los Angeles County. And from what we noticed, this population is Filipino immigrant men and women. So the Filipino Worker Center has been gracious in providing us some of their members, and of course from there we spoke to members that can refer us to other workers that are not part of that organization. Our study is both a quantitative and a qualitative design, so it's a hybrid. We do this qualitatively through the interviews. We talk to them about the personal life, the background, things of like that sort. And we do the quantitative through three ways. The sleep log, which is done for a whole 7 days. The Epworth scale, which really talks about the, you know, dozing off, how prone they are to sleeping on whatever activities they do. The Pittsburgh scale is to look into how much sleep they can get, what are the disruptors of those sleep. So that's kind of being as comprehensive, and that's thanks to those like Dr. Kevin Riley and, of course, Dr. Sterling Mollish. So the first thing, sleep log right here. So this is kind of a little bit of a sample of how it looks like. This is for 7 days. We give them a start date or end date. We either tell them to circle to work or home. We put it in 30-minute increments. And if you want to just notice what the symbols are, the little shady part is to show that the time when they're actually getting sleep. The down arrow is when they're lying down, and the up arrow is when they finally get up from lying down. Now, of course, we told them that when you put the down arrow, it does not equate to actually getting sleep. So we tell them only shade it if you actually got sleep around that time. And for work only, meal and breaks were supposed to be documented in terms of how long they get meals and breaks, just to see if they actually do. From our interview, we did have some various questions. It's about 20 or 23. Questions. Some of them are, do you have an agreement with your employer about sleep and meal break arrangements? Do you have coworkers? And do you have problems with your patient's attitude or behavior? Or sometimes we ask about the employer also. So all this from here on out are updated results. So initially we did only four. We were able to do only four complete process, because these are long process, mind you. There are 7-day week long, so we have to find a day for them to be day off to actually give them the sleep log, wait for another 7 days, and reschedule again to give this at least an hour or less of an interview. So this is great progress. From here on the summer all till this fall, we have 16 workers, including four informants. Informants are basically those who do not necessarily qualify, who did no longer qualify because of their work, but we still believe that their information can tell us how we can expand our criteria. And these are for those who completed the full process sleep log and interview. And moreover, we're also in contact with 10 more workers, and also we're trying to get in touch with facilities, and I'll explain what the significance of that is later on. The sleep log and survey results, these are not much, so you can feel free to ask about anything that might interest you. But on average, more than half of the workers wake up 2 to 3 times per night, so interruptions. 10 out of the 12 workers needed 30 minutes or more to fall asleep. And 9 out of 12 workers had interrupted sleep. You can see that in the nice little pie graph right there. And here it is about the average. So this is a mean. This is not necessarily the median, just in case, because there are a wide range. So there's something that's very large. Somebody gets 10 hours, and somebody gets very low, like 1.79. So on average, workers get about 6.05 hours of sleep a day, but on average, the largest chunk of sleep that workers receive without interruption is 6.5. The data kind of is interesting, but when you look at the sleep logs, it varies. So the qualitative results. 10 out of 12 workers are, this is a typo, this is 10 out of 12 workers are hired through an agency, not through a direct hire. The reason being, they wanted some security with their jobs. And the other part is, all these workers filed for taxes as independent contractors, a 1099. I-10. And the pie graph here doesn't talk about it in the bullet points, but this is a pie graph telling you workers with or without a formal agreement about employer sleep or meal breaks. We see out of 8 of 12 workers have a formal agreement, while 4 do not. Most of these workers use the bus, so they take 2 hours by bus. 7 out of 12 workers, I'll give you a story. There's one person who lives in Eagle Rock, has to wake up every day to go, well, to start her work all the way to San Pedro, and when she gets back, she goes all the way back there. So that's how far they can go. Some of them can go from downtown LA all the way to Camarillo, Ventura County. All the workers administer medications and patients in a system with some form of ambulation. So as you can see, this is why we're trying to make the connection here. The challenges to data collection, well, there's a lot of challenges, but here's the four main ones. One is because they're very hard to reach populations. So technically, the work we've done is some good progress because nobody has done this and they are very hard to reach. That is because the fact that they cannot leave the workplace or do not know the next time they have a day off. Some cannot leave the workplace because some are in these facilities, which we have found to be parts in the San Fernando Valley, and which they are there for all 7 days. This is their housing. That's where they're stuck in. And the only time they'll leave is when they wanted to switch out to doing just with only one patient. Workers may not qualify for a project as the work is incumbent on the patient's health condition. So, for example, we had a worker 1 week ago who was eligible to be part of our program, but we made him an informant because his patient died, so he was out of that job. So he was no longer an active primary caregiver. That being said, of course, unpredictable schedules is very tough, not only for my... our schedules, but of course their schedules too, so it's very hard to work with. And of course the other part is with the sleep logs. They're working so hard that it's very hard to them to always give an accurate report, and sometimes they do this at the end of the day, and sometimes they're trying to do this retroactively with, like, how much they sleep they got, when they had the breaks, etc. So I'm going to just share you, this is an old kind of story, but I can share some more if you'd like. This one is for Karen, of course. The name is used for anonymity. She's 57 years old, and just some more information with her. She was a person who worked with somebody who was diabetic, actually with a bunch of other patients, and she's at this age. She gets paid $130 per day. It's not per hour, but we're doing the daily time record per hour. We want to write it out. That's what the agency told us. My time sheet there, we put 8 to 5, but only we're working 24 hours. There's a lot of problems like this. So she was referring to wage theft. And, of course, being the day of wage theft, this is something very interesting right now with our community. She also says, I'm used to it. Sleep less. My immune system, I can take it. I'm half awake at night, even if my day off. I usually sleep 1:30 and get up to 3 o'clock, 5:30, get ready to go to the job again. So you can just see why it is so essential that we need to change the policies. Now, being from a policy background for me, not really for the health one, but with labor, we understood this AB 241 is an impressive achievement, but it is not enough. Because it expires in 2017, the sleep provisions were removed and also for rest and meal breaks. We hope to push it with the Filipino Workers Center to push for another domestic workers' bill of rights that actually provide these specific health provisions that actually enforce their conditions properly. So give back safety training. We initially, I'll explain to you the other give back that we did, but this is one that I'm currently doing right now with a friend of mine from SoCal Quash. And what I said to him is, we need to do something, a safety curriculum. It was kind of inspired when we saw the car wash workers, how they gave a curriculum. We want to kind of do the same thing with sleep because there's not a lot of health and safety trainings around that. So we're in the process of trying to do this in terms of research and in terms of trying to apply that. Hopefully we can get a draft or at least something by at the beginning of next year. The other one of this was a postcard for workers. Now we know to help out the Worker Center, they really work with this community. So we said, well, why not give a postcard that asks these questions about adequate rest and in terms of having these conditions and connect them with the Filipino Workers Center and see what they can do. And here's reflection time. I don't have the mirror in my face in there, but at least there are some bullet points to work with. Now, these are my personal reflections, and being someone of also a Filipino origin, it's very interesting. When I came to the work, every time I have to call them, and I'm like, hi, I'm with UCLA, I'm trying to do this sleep project that they recommended me to you, and then their first question is, are you Filipino? So I'm like, yes, and this is the time where I have to realize I have to learn my language again and really communicate with them. But it's been a great moment to speak with these workers. They're so humble and they're so generous. They're so thankful that we're doing this work. I have this thing, I'm coming to interview them, and she says, would you like lunch? I'm like, what? No. But she's so willing. I was like, okay, well, I can't really do this about that. But it's so amazing, being from a labor and workplace studies background, being that student, and also working with the UCLA Labor Center, I always love building relationships with workers. It's such a great experience, and I understand this is something that really drives me to know that, especially from an immigrant background, that our workers are getting, exploited all the time. We need to change those things, and it's just to be able to do this research, no matter how hard it is, it's so great for me to be supporting them. And of course, sharing their worker stories. I've known this when I've done my immigrant organizing, to share stories influence policy. And their stories are really powerful. And the other part, too, is, you know, as I said, the reason why also I'm so glad to do OHIP was because I'm coming into a public health degree and coming with not too much of a health background, but thanks to my mom, she did have some medical background, but not necessarily this way. I'm really, my focus is to change my public policy concentration to not just health policy, but one that concentrates on building an intersectionality with health, labor, and in the international focus. So that's been an inspiring thing, and I do want to continue working in occupational safety and health. So I just want to give an acknowledgement to the Filipino Worker Center, OHIP, AOEC, APALA, the California Wellness Foundation, and NIOSH. Okay. Hopefully we have time for questions. Yes. Actually, I'm not going to say this is trafficking, but maybe you can put it this way. So, you know, there's an interesting dynamic, especially with Filipinos and, of course, some API workers where, you know, a lot of them, they like to say, oh, we're family. The boss likes to tell the workers, yeah, we're family. So what they do is they bring these immigrant Filipinos. They say, yeah, come on in. There's great jobs. And they, even though they become undocumented or they don't have papers, they come into this community. And the boss says, yeah, we're familiar. You know where this is. But, of course, they're exploiting them in these conditions. One of them, I found out that there's a lot of these incubation. I call these facilities incubation facilities because they're really this place for all these immigrants to come in, forcibly trained to mop, do all these horrible work, you know, really long-term work, care for the patients, care for two or three patients at a time, be cooped up with all these workers, and then once they really find out that I'm tired of working with this person, they move on. But that's kind of the scenario. Hopefully that answers your question. But that is a scenario for a lot of these workers. They're pushing into this kind of interesting pipeline funnel where they aren't going into, like, Beverly Hills, all these places where they're taking care of the old and, of course, the ill. So that's... Yes. For me, in a sense that I wanted to make this as expansive as possible. I think really with the culture, it's really with them because they're just talking to them, actually trying to get this within their own language, trying to bring it to an understanding that they can. Because I know with my research and with our research when we were talking to them, sometimes it's, you know, that even though we know Tagalog or something like that, it's still tough with the cultural background. So we want to try to understand that worker population more in order to try to bring that. But for really my part here is that we know that other immigrant populations are in here too. I've heard of Tongan caregivers and things like this. So we want to try to make this as broad as possible in order to understand, you know, something that's immigrant friendly, something that's friendly to these workers, and something that to bring them community while we're doing this training. So, for example, within the training we're trying to plan to do, we want to do this as a group effort, not just one-on-one, so they can give tips to each other too. So hopefully that answers it. Yes. Technically twice a week. Once a week coming in, once a week coming back. So. Yes. So that's what I was referring to those facilities. Some people are just like that situation. And sometimes it's not also a bad thing. Sometimes they find some really nice families who are willing to take care of them. So instead of just getting their housing, they just said, well, why not just stay here? You know, I'm free to move around. I can do this. So those are the situations. But with terms of the bus, people who take the bus, that's generally the case. They do have time for day off, but there's some people who just don't. So it's still something to think about how that's possible. But, yeah. Yes, ma'am. I can't fully describe that yet because that's still pending, but this is what we have been told. by the workers and also some other people who want to try to help us come into those facilities. But really what it is if you ever see like those convalescent homes and stuff like that, it's really kind of like that, except they're there on the clock almost for 7 days, or in fact all 7 days. So that's pretty much what we've heard, but we'll try to confirm that as time goes on with us, because with their holidays and stuff like that, it's been hard to really get into those things. So thank you.